Hello.
How the hell are you?
Fine.
Wait, let me put my ears in.
I'm actually gonna keep working. I'm doing some weaving, so I'm gonna keep going. But I'll listen in. I'll be listening.
When are you leaving?
No, I'm just doing some weaving.
Oh,
And I only have a little light left before the end of the day, so I'm going to
weeding like the garden or something.
weaving.
Oh, weaving. Well, don't they have electricity up there in Quebec?
Yeah, but the light, it's always the daylight that works. It doesn't work with artificial light. It's not great, so
Okay.
I only weave in daylight.
Do you have anything you could show us that you've
Well, I just have this thing that I'm working on, which is so it's a silk scarf that I'm working on.
And that is that like the first thing that you've done?
No, it's the second thing. I did a sampler first, just to sort of try out different patterns. So this is the first real thing that I'm doing.
All right. Yeah, so the artist needs the proper light to,
Exactly.
yeah, okay, I can dig it.
And it'll
Thank
make
you.
noise, so I'll shut
Oh,
up.
it isn't a foot pedal, like,
No, it's an all hand thing.
well, I can't, I,
It doesn't make a lot of noise. It's just that
oh, the bar's going like this.
Yeah, exactly.
I had, I don't know, a long, long time ago, somebody I knew had one, and I think they wove me a scarf, but I still have this. And she was from Vancouver, British Columbia. But it was oh, so many years ago. So I don't. If I saw her in the street, I wouldn't even recognize her.
So you can hear the sound. It's just the lever.
Oh,
It's just the levers going up and down.
clacking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back,
Yeah.
back, back.
Well, there's Doug's brain. You don't. Oh, there he is.
Hello.
Hello.
What's up, Douglas?
Just hanging in the teen section at the library.
Oh, it's a library. Is it a school library or a city library?
The county.
County library. And there's the poet.
Does he know it?
I think so.
I do.
I think from on occasion he's called himself a poet.
Yes, he has. Yeah. He's a brave man.
Having technical difficulties with my microphone and audio setup. Can you hear me okay?
No.
Not very well. And Ed, you're a little foggy.
I'm foggy?
Foggy.
Okay. Let me see if I can do something.
Is it dark there in
Oh, it's dark here. It gets dark here about 4 o'clock.
and it's much
It's eight
later than
o'clock
that.
now.
It's 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. Yeah. It gets light about 8:30.
Oh my.
But the shortest day is coming.
what's the parallel line?
The latitude?
Yeah.
We're at about 50 degrees.
Oh. That's way up there.
Well, we're south of London.
I don't remember London. I lived in England for 2 years.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, and I don't remember the weather.
Yeah, it's further north. Scotland is it's starting to get Scandinavian, you know. I just heard from my brother's my nephew's in the Marines, and he's doing his Arctic training in northern Norway. He's up near the Arctic Circle, and they have 6 hours of twilight a day. Mm-hmm. it never gets really light.
That's Alaska-like.
Yeah. Well, that's the other place they send them. But he was on this. They had this big NATO maneuver, going on. So he was there for that. And now they're testing a new Arctic gear.
they're keeping an eye on the Russians, are they?
I don't know. All I know is that when I hear him speak of the military, it sounds a lot like the military I was in. I don't think some things have changed all that much.
Weapons have gotten better.
Yeah, they've gotten better, but the situation, I think, is pretty standard. I don't think it's ever really changed. A lot of boredom, a lot of crappy food.
A lot of sitting around.
A lot of sitting around. They don't have anywhere to, you know.
But they have porn now. The porn is way better. Right?
Yeah, well, back in the day, you know, if you didn't have a projector, you know, you needed to film, you had to have a room. Electricity, it was awful.
Black and white magazine.
Yeah. That hasn't changed either, I'm sure. Okay, well, that's not why we're here, to discuss life in the military.
Anyway, yeah, you got rid of the fog. It's much
okay. Easier. Yeah, I usually have a little sticky thing that's over the camera, and so sometimes I misplace it and I get the glue on there, and I have to clean it off every once in a while. So if I'm out of the fog, at least externally, I can assure you that inside it's just as it was.
Cloud of unknowing.
Well, that would be nice if we got that far. That's one of the goals we've got set. Get at least to there.
Well, yeah.
Do we need a countdown to start?
I don't know. How are we going to do this? What do you think, Doug?
Well, it looks like it's already recording, so the countdown doesn't necessarily need to occur.
The countdown has already taken effect, and I think the person that called the meeting should start.
So just to let you guys know, I'm listening, but I'm working on my weaving because while there's still light outside. So if somebody asks for me, I'll come back in, but otherwise I'll be hanging in the background. Okay.
Well, just briefly, Jeffrey, have you read that book or
I've read about half of it.
Okay.
It did go quickly, but I have had other things to do, so I haven't been able to read it all. But it is a lovely book, I have to say. So I will finish it.
It's not the kind of book you want to speed through either.
No.
And on the little video, I think Mark, you put it up. The first of her two readings is the one I read, and the other one I hadn't. But
the other one is near the back of the book.
But I love
which I found really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but take it away, Doug.
So I didn't necessarily propose the idea, but I did post the cafe topic. So I don't mind starting out and maybe passing the torch off to Marco, who did propose the actual reading. And your audio is much better now, Marco, from the few words you've, your pithy response earlier. So, but I guess I can give a history of how I came about the book, which ties in with the actual reason why John Ames wrote the book. But I had started writing letters to quite a few people, which I mentioned. Can anyone hear me at this point?
Oh, yeah. It just threw me because the author of the book was Robinson. And you said John Ames. John Ames was the actual preacher or whatever you call them.
He's the main character of the book who is doing the writing of the letters.
Oh, okay.
But I took a pause there. I'm double checking to make sure you can hear me. Everybody's video is frozen right now. So you can hear me?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. All right. So I guess it's the video frozen here. So
we did lose you there.
All right. I'm not understanding why I have full service here, but I'll continue on. And if I can't be understood, then yell at me or mute me and take over. But I had started writing letters to individuals in my life, my mother, my father, friends. And I also had the idea to write letters to my son, who at the time was not speaking just yet. So I couldn't directly verbally have a conversation with him. So I was thinking, well, I'll spend my time writing to him. And then one of my friends, who happens to be a preacher, his name isn't John Ames, but he recommended highly this book, perhaps his favorite book. He said it's one of his favorites. And when I started reading it, I said, well, this is pretty cool. It parallels with kind of what I'm doing here, although I'm not dying as the main character states that he is approaching the end of his days and wants to get out some information to his son, who's sounds like he's 7, 8, 9. I can't remember the exact age. So he can have a conversation with his son, but he's unable to discuss theology, discuss philosophy, discuss kind of the deeper aspects of life. John Ames seems to be a deep thinker. He's definitely Christian, but at the same time, he's well read. He starts off the first few pages of the book. His brother, his older brother Edward, has knowledge. Who is a self-proclaimed atheist going against this long line of preachers from John Ames, his father and his father before him, his grandfather, were all preachers. And so Edward introduces quite a few books to the author or the writer of the letters, John Ames. And that kind of opens, even though Gilead is a small town, even though this is a kind of hole in the wall, so to speak, town in which his brother Edward extracts himself from this small town. Even though John Ames is in this, it just makes the decision to stay in this town and be a preacher in a small town. He is perhaps more well-read than what you would imagine any other preacher in a small town would be. He's read quite a few authors on both sides of the aisle. Without going into full discussion here, essentially the book is these letters that he's writing to his young son. And they're is essentially not much plot. It meanders as perhaps an older man's mind might meander, or a person writing letters to their son would meander. So there is that sort of rhythm throughout the book that's flowing from one thought to the next. So there is some coherence, and near the end of the book, there is quite a bit of a plot that develops in a certain sense, at least that ties together the present aspects of a few individuals that are introduced and ties in the past with the present. But I think I'll stop there. I think others would have a bit more to say than I do about the actual content of the book. So maybe I'll pass it off to you, Marco. You made the proposal. I'm wondering how you came about reading this book or hearing about it. You are muted.
Okay, so my audio is okay now? I think after Christmas, I might have a better setup. We use an Amazon wish list with my in-laws and my wife's mother. Just does her Christmas shopping from Amazon wish list. Our Amazon wish list. That's the only. That's how it has to happen. If we don't do that, the whole gift giving ritual can't proceed smoothly. And so I just finished reading the book this morning. I had been taking it easy and reading little bits at a time and sort of relaxing into the pace of the narrative, which, as you noted, Doug, is slower and meandering. I would say thoughtful. I think that he's this Reverend John Ames is he's a thoughtful kind of preacher. I think he's I don't want to get into his character so much. More like, why are we reading this? Like, how did this come about? And like, what might be the significance of a book like this? I was trying to remember how it came to my attention, and I can't remember exactly. I'm pretty sure that I picked it up, the book, downtown, either at the library or in my neighborhood, because we have a number of these little free libraries. They're like cute little houses with little doors and windows, and people put books out that you can take for free and leave. And I might have found it in one of the free libraries or in the public library. But I think the reason that I was attracted to it, or the reason that it came into my awareness, is because on our forum, on Infinite Conversations, there's been at least a couple of people have brought up Christianity as a topic of discussion. And, I think the proposal, or what they seem to be, saying, and I'm thinking specifically of Fred and Katina, and you could go on the forum, and anybody who's watching this, you could find their posts, or we could link to them. But, there's like in our discourse, more broadly speaking, social political moment, right, in the United States, and it's different in different countries. Ed could probably speak to the European context better, but certainly in the United States, there's a huge divide between rural, traditional Christian America and modern, progressive, liberal America. And it's a geographical divide. You have the more progressive, modern, kind of on the coasts and in these pockets, these like bastions of liberalism in the middle part of the country. I'm thinking of places like Madison, Wisconsin, and Austin, Texas, and the Boulder, Colorado area. Colorado is sort of a special case, but there is this divide in our way of seeing the world, in our way of communicating, our values, and just the horizons of life, the life worlds that we live in. And I think, and this is the first book by Marilynne Robinson that I've read. I may have recognized her name as an author, but I really didn't know anything about her. And so I listened to a couple of interviews, and I listened to her reading that you posted, Mark. And it seems like she's somebody who, as an artist, as her intellectual and her artistic part of her, and her spiritual, I think, purpose, is to maybe bring the perspective of that traditional Christian rural America to a broader audience, to a more broadly American audience. She's been very successful. She won the Pulitzer Prize for this book, National Book Critics Circle Award. She was interviewed by Barack Obama for one of the, I don't know which magazine, the New York Book, Review of Books or whatever. So she's very successful, and I think she's representing this, I hesitate to call it a tradition, but some stream in American thought that is integrative in some way of the values and ideals of the Republic, what America aspired to be, and the more rural, traditional, and grounded ways of being that this preacher, I think, is representing and standing for, holding a place for. So this book takes place, these letters from John Ames, Reverend John Ames, to his son. It's in 1956. It's a small town called Gilead, fictional town in Iowa, based on the author Marilyn Robinson's hometown, which was also in Iowa. And the town is unremarkable in all the ways that John Ames finds exceptional beauty in, actually. But to just the ordinary eye, it would appear to be a small town with not much to it. A shabby church, maybe a few different denominations, Presbyterians, Methodists, Congregationalists, Baptists. But it had a history that was significant in terms of American history, relating to the Civil War and slavery. It was one of the, I guess, these middle zones in middle America where abolitionists were clashing with people who would become Confederates in the Civil War. And John Ames's grandfather was a fanatic abolitionist who, he describes him very vividly as having lost one eye because he, took up arms for the cause of freeing the slaves. And he incited his own congregation to war. And this became a great point of division between himself and his son, that is to say, the narrator's father, also named John Ames, because the son of the grandfather, that's getting confusing, but he became a pacifist. So he went and joined the Quakers. And although they remained deferential and respectful to each other in the way that reverends would do, addressing each other as reverend and so forth, there was a deep divide between them. And in some way, I think that this narrator, John Ames, who's reflecting back on his family's history, on the political history, on the theology, really, of the righteousness of the cause, that his grandfather was representing versus the grave, I think, problem in pursuing violent means, even for a justified end. He's bringing some kind of, I think, in my view, a balanced perspective to it, some way of bringing those together. And I think that's what the author, and probably why Obama was attracted to her work as well, and lists it as one of his favorite books. I think the author is trying to bring this, certainly this a Christian perspective, certainly a religious perspective, but also an integrative perspective from an American tradition. Like she's trying to bring that into greater, I think, awareness or great into the culture. And it's probably a losing battle, I think, and it's probably a futile in some ways. But what I think she's giving us in this novel is an attempt to express the truth as she sees it, and to, you know, through the lens of a person who, a preacher who, to the popular imagination is actually a very stereotyped figure. And she's giving us his inner life. And he's a man who's coming to the end of his life. He's reflecting back on his family. But a very interesting thing happens, which is that we have this prodigal son kind of archetype play out, where I'll just kind of give this and I'll let others start to fill other things in. But he has a good friend in the town. Who is what's Botton's first name?
Does he have one?
I don't know.
He has one. If you only ever calls him Botton.
You know? So he's a fellow preacher. He's a Presbyterian minister, and they're childhood friends. They grew up together. He was
called Bobby.
Bobby?
There's a reference at the very beginning somewhere.
Robert. Maybe it was Robert.
He was called Bobby when he was a child, before he was called Barton. So,
okay, well, maybe it was Robert, but anyhow, they're lifelong friends. They've grown from childhood to adulthood. They're both ministers, and they've shared this vocation together. But John Ames, he lost his wife and child soon after he got married. His wife's name was Louisa, I believe, and his child Rebecca. And so he went through many years, decades of being alone. Whereas in contrast, his friend Botton, Bobby, had many children and prospered in that sense. Except for there was one child that he had whose name was Jack, who he named after his friend, John Ames. So he named, Jack was his nickname, but he named him John Ames Botton. So there's a son who turns out to be a kind of prodigal son. Like, he is a rascal. He's always causing trouble. He steals. He lights mailboxes on fire. And he gets into some trouble when he's an adolescent in college. He gets a very young girl pregnant, and she's a very poor person from a poor family. And then he, for various kind of complex social reasons, like, he abandons them, his child, but his family, Botton and John Ames, they try to take care of it, but ultimately the child gets an injury, gets sick and dies. And Jack Botton leaves and goes off to live a life that nobody knows much about, but he becomes estranged. He becomes, from his family, but he was also the apple of his father's eye. So we're kind of replaying a biblical story. And he comes back and begins spending time with Ames's son and with his wife. And the old preacher, who, was really kind of, I think, in the mode of reminiscing, of trying to tell his story to his son and prepare for his own death, he becomes very perturbed by this because he's threatened. He feels threatened by Jack. He sees that, one important detail is that his wife is a lot younger than he is. He met her decades later, and he has a very interesting description of her. She seems, in fact, Robinson dedicated a novel to her. This is the first book in a trilogy. So there's a book called Leela, I believe, which is all about her. But she's younger, and he begins to worry that maybe Jack could become a bad influence. He deeply distrusts him. He doesn't
trust his character, but he has to in some way love him and has to in some way forgive him, because that's what he has to do as a Christian. And he's struggling with this. He feels foolish. He feels ashamed even to be having these kinds of feelings, having this kind of reaction. And he's documenting it for his son. So there's a profound confessional quality to this, where he, in a way, wants to demonstrate to his son how he's dealing with this situation. I won't go further than that, other to say that you know, part of what surprised me in the reading is how a very meditative kind of narrative, which you know had these historical and theological dimensions to it, how it suddenly became very personal and disturbed. And then finally, in the denouement of the book, we learn the details of Jack's current life, and it's a surprise to me. It was a surprising turn, but very interesting, because it ties back then to the historical narrative with the grandfather and slavery and, you know, the history of race in America. So there are many things in play here in this novel. I don't really want to, I don't feel appropriate speaking as a critic or a reviewer, but to me, just from that perspective, it felt like a very successful novel. I think it touched on issues that are, you know, red hot today, even if they are smoldering under the surface. And it, the prose is so well crafted and the thought so, just thoughtful, unpretentious, clear, lucid, but honest. Like there's a truthfulness or feeling of truthfulness, I think, in the text that, you know, like is very refreshing, and it's very different than the dominant mood of sort of postmodern culture. And to me, in that way, it's kind of an antidote to that. And so when, you know, in response to Katina and Fred bringing up the question of Christianity and like the way in which in this kind of inversion, it becomes let's talk about that. I mean, let's come back to that, but it becomes almost a persecuted perspective in the modern world. So they've wanted to, I think, offer some kind of apologetics for it. And I think that this book, being a novel, not being, including theology, but not being theological or not being philosophical only, I felt like it would be a good prism for examining like those questions and issues, and also for the opportunity to just spend the time in the mind of somebody who is taking life and looking at life in a very different way, and you know really has not ventured beyond this small village except in his mind, because he is a very deep thinker and a deep reader, and that studiousness really, you know, comes through in his voice and his views of things. So I'm curious what everybody else thinks. I really enjoyed the book, and I'm glad we're having the opportunity here at the end of the year, especially to reflect on it.
Can I pick up on what you were just saying? I got to the book because you said you wanted to discuss it on the 18th of December. That was the first time I had heard of it. That's the first time I ever seen the name. That's the first time I even knew that this person existed. And I go, okay, if you guys want to talk about it, I'll read it. I'm absolutely delighted that I was made to stumble across it, so to speak. You know, I don't generally think about these kinds of things, you know, like how do I come to read a book? I see, like you, I was in the store, I picked it up, I look at it, it seemed interesting, I took it home, and 3 years later, I pull it off the shelf because I'm bored, and it's, you know, one of the most marvelous experiences that you have. When we talked earlier in one of our cafes about our five favorite books, and I had mentioned The Sorrows of Young Werther, That was one of those books laid up here on my bookshelf for years. And then I go, I guess I'll have to read it. And what I found, there was, I think it's very appropriate in this, that was also just a series of letters. Here he's writing one to his son. And The Sorrows of Young Werther is in a series of letters that the friend writes to the narrator, who then ends up killing himself over this unrequited love that he can have. And so it was also a novel without a plot. And I'm absolutely fascinated by novels that don't have plots, because they can work. And Goethe's worked well, and this one works beautifully. There is a little bit of a kind of a storyline, but you get it towards the end and you impose it back on everything else that you've done. Because the idea of sharing with someone else how you see life when you're older is not that uncommon. You know, Doug, who isn't all that old, said, you know, well, I thought about writing a letter to my own son before he even stumbled across it. I've been working on one for my grandkids for 3 years. It was just like, it just seems like the right thing to do. And I was really pleased to see, well, it's not that odd. I'm not, you know, I didn't think this is all that. At the time, you know, why am I writing to people that are probably never going to read this? But the idea is I approach the things that I say when I write in that, much like Ames approaches what he does. I really love the way he goes about it. He has some thought, and you can, and that's why meandering is okay in the one sense. Because he just kind of follows the flow of the stream where it's going to go. But all of a sudden, you go around a corner and he's right in the middle of a deep contemplation that literally, in many instances, just kind of like whips you around again and goes, but it's about this. And it's extremely focused. And it highlights, like you had said, Marco, things that we kind of have in the back of our mind, but don't bring up into the forefront of our mind often enough. Why are we? How do we do these things? Why is it so okay to live in Gilead and not go anywhere? Why am I not like my brother who went off to Germany and became the Herr Doctor and the self-proclaimed atheist who did his dissertation on Feuerbach, who was the most Christian atheist that ever existed? Which he also brings out in the book, when you realize, well, you really don't have to play by the book to appreciate what the book's telling you, in that case, the Bible. And this is where what I liked about Ames himself. He found a lot of his inspiration for things that came out of life. And the Bible was simply a vehicle to help explain those or to bring those across to other people who were looking to him because he's the preacher. I also found it very interesting that he never referred to his best friend by his first name. We have trouble remembering. Maybe it is Robert, you know. But it's if he had called him anything else, I don't think it would have been as personal. Because there was that we're kind of one, and his best friend names his oldest son after his best friend. You know, there which is a very odd. You know, you end up with a junior that's not your junior, but somehow you're involved. You know, there's this really intricate little knot that gets tied in the middle of this. But I found absolutely exquisite, because it keeps everything together. There are really no loose ends when you're going through it, which is what I like the most about the book. What I also liked about it is it reminded me very, very much of my own youth. I'm about the same age as Ames' son that he's writing to. I'm the old man that his son was. And I'm reading the book. That was a good one. That was probably the best part. Because I can see myself in a lot of what he's saying. I remember a lot of the things that he talked about, the Kiefhofer. I was only 7 years old at the time, but you know, I remember my parents they were kicking that stuff around. That was important to them. This was a big deal. He decided he's reading the newspaper to form his political opinion. know, who does that anymore? He's sitting on the porch reading in the paper, actually consciously forming a political opinion and who he might vote for. You know, those were heady days. I remember my father saying back then he couldn't vote for Adlai Stevenson because he was too intellectual. And in the end, he voted for Eisenhower because he was a general. You know, my dad never got out of World War II either. Okay, but it does bring my own youth into a clearer focus because it's very close to what I was doing. She captured that exceedingly well. There was a authenticity about how she described those times and places that reminded me of growing up in a small coal mining town, as opposed to out on the prairie somewhere. There was a few of those images that you know don't really associate with deep-rooted, gnarly-footed, gnome-type people like Western Pennsylvanians. But that feeling about rootedness in where I am and where I come from, that comes across very strong. That's what the Germans call Heimat. That's also something that here is very strong. So like you were saying, there's a bigger difference between rural and urban America, but there's also a very big difference between rural and urban Germany, even though it's much smaller. And if you're a city person, you'll stick out in the country. And if you're a country person, you'll stick out in the city. It becomes immediately apparent you're not from here. You see the world so differently, even though there's a lot of overlaps and a lot of sharing of that. So that is kind of a universal thing. But where people are born here matters to them, regardless of where they go in the world. It matters to them. This is where I come from. It's the geography, it's the topography that you get connected to. That you can't let go. There are lots and lots of, one of the reasons I feel very comfortable where I am here, this looks like Western Pennsylvania. This looks like where I grew up, geographically, topologically. So I never felt estranged in any way. And then a lot of the things and the customs and the way things went here happened a lot more like it happened in small town Western Pennsylvania than let's say in a bigger city or Pittsburgh or whatnot. So that also helps. And so I was able to adopt this and adapt to this surrounding that I feel very much at home here because I don't have that sense of Heimat that others do. But I did want to at least highlight the fact that that Robinson really picked up on that, the vibe, the rhythm of that time. I remember that as well. Things did operate at a different pace. He has a lot of recollections about his grandfather who lost an eye in the Civil War. When my father died, my brothers cleaned out the house. They found 12 letters that my great great grandfather had written to his wife while he was in the Civil War. He couldn't read and write himself, so he had to speak to somebody who wrote them. So all the letters were in different handwritings. And we just have the letters he wrote to her about his time. He died of dysentery 2 years after he got in. He never went back home. So that Civil War connection was there. My grandparents were born the same time. He went out looking for his grandfather's grave with his father. So all of those stories about their childhood, it all rang true because of things that I had heard in my own family as I was growing up. So I think that's one of the things that endeared the book to me as well, because I was able to establish this personal connection to it. But I think even without that, well, you're a lot younger than I am, and so is Doug, you still get a personal connection. And that's what she does so well in the way she puts that book together is getting us into this personal connection between things. So anyhow, that's my initial impression.
I got a little, can you clarify something? So the narrator, the writer, is how old when he's writing this? Ames, the character? Anyone?
76?
That's right. He's 76. I think he has a birthday during the book. So.
Yeah. I think he turned 77 in the book.
And his and his son, you said, was 8 or 9?
Seven.
So he had had the son when he was in his 71 or something.
69, 70.
Oh, that's my age.
Yeah. Still hope, Mark.
Well, that's again. I didn't read the book, and I have a obvious or usually as usual, I have a different take than all of you on it, just from hearing her read it and doing a little, you know, research on it and things like that. And of course, I look at things stylistically and things like that. But the second passage she reads, which is closer to the end of the book than the beginning of the book, where she's talking about, Robinson, is writing from the perspective of a man who is 70 some years old and lusting after this young female parishioner. And so that's like a fabrication. There's no way she knows what that's like. Now I know what it's like, sort of. But obviously it rings true to all of you. But she has no way of getting inside a preacher, 70-year-old preacher's head, looking at however old that girl was, 20 or something, who becomes the mother of the child. Then, and it's sort of so I that bothers me, but it brings to mind two other books. One I have right behind me, the other's in the garage. One was I won it in a contest reading my poem in Oregon at this thing. And I was awarded second place. And the book was called Nordy's Gift. Nordy is the guy's wife's name. And it's a story about a rural Oregon, and the guy Nordy is his wife, and he falls in love with a younger woman, and Nordy allows him the freedom to pursue his lustful desire for the younger woman. Now I have to say I never read the whole book. The other book, let's see if I can grab it here. Where is it? Here it is. Very, very similar style. See how it's over 1,000 pages written. It's almost 1,200 pages written by a female author in, I think it's 19, I should find it here, 1965. It's called Miss McIntosh, My Darling. And it's somewhat more authentic, same style, in that it's a reflection about a person's life. But it's written by a woman, about another woman. So I feel that it's more authentic because it's coming from a place that she knows the inner workings of the female, you know, it's probably a lot of her. And it's also what I call the same stylistically, I call it MFA writing, which when I talked about way back when the perfect words, the different reasons George Orwell say you write, one of the four was aesthetically. That's kind of what I call MFA writing. You know, beautiful prose. It's very intentional. And this book, Miss McIntosh, My Darling, it's just some paragraphs are half a page long, and the writing is really, you know, what we'd call beautiful. I find it somewhat tedious and sort of, I had it by my bedside for a long time. If I needed to go to sleep, I'd start reading a little bit of it. So yeah, I have a different take on it. Some of what you said, I can very much see the positive aspects of it, like talking about growing up rural, the time, in other words, the setting and the let's call them political issues about the historical. So she's got the historical motive and the aesthetic motive and apparently political impulse also. So it's just a woman writing about the inner workings of a man. Of course, we men have been guilty of that a lot. You know, it's just it's a tough way to as a reader, I just question it. Okay, where'd you get your inner workings of a 70-year-old preacher man from? You made it up. Or you may have interviewed someone or known someone, but again, it's a fabrication. It's not, you know. So, you know, but once it's on a printed page and people read it, then they tend to believe that. It has an impact.
Well, I would like to just introduce a bookmark right there, because I think you're bringing up an interesting question, which is...
That's my job.
Sure. but I'm not... The question would be, you know, what is the validity or the legitimacy of an artist representing the point of view of another, of a person whose identity that they don't share? I think that that's an interesting question. We could probably phrase it better than I just did, but that's more or less what you're getting at. How could a woman write about a man? And you know, I think that, you know, and that could go in any direction. How could a man write about a woman? How could a white person write about a black person? How could one person from one culture, one sexual orientation, or any number of other qualities write about any experience other than their own particular one? And I think that that would be an interesting question to explore, but I'm not sure that, I'm not sure it's like that is fair to the book, because whether or not, you know, it's an accurate representation, there's something being communicated. There's some in the fictional world, a character being conjured, and whether or not it's real or accurate to is, I think, in a way secondary, because when we step into the story, when we step into the space of the story, when we suspend our disbelief, if you will, if that's what we're doing, then something is happening in that world that has to be, I think, met on its own terms. You know, in a way, you know, not before, but I think if we only have the meta conversation about whether or not, you know, about the kind of identity and representation, I think we may miss part of the deeper meaning or message that the author as an artist, however she's identified, is tapping into and getting across. Like, there is something more going on than here in however we might fall, like looking at the identity question. There's something more going on internally in the story, and I wouldn't want that to get lost. That's all. Like, I think that the part of what she's doing as a writer, just as an artist, whatever you want to say about the validity of the perspectives, is that she's establishing a tone. She's establishing a voice. She's establishing character. She's establishing drama and conflict between those characters. She's establishing an internal space of the narrator, you know, who, real or not in actual terms, is, you know, we can resonate with, or we could sympathize with, because even though they're not ourselves, this is a 77-year-old man. I've never been a 77-year-old man, but how is it that I can resonate with one? Something happens there in that literary space, but it's also the space of scripture. It's also the space of mythos, and so the power, the value, the effect of story is, I think, part of one the themes here. Like, and so looking at what that actually means internally in the novel, I think would be more valuable than, you know, whether or not the identity politics of it, because that would be an interesting philosophical conversation. But there's something I think here that I want to bring out, because I think it's getting at like what Katina is talking about and what Fred is talking about. Like, what is, and I'm not identified as a Christian, right? So I'm really coming more from the modern perspective. But what is the value of this Christian ethos, this Christian worldview, this Christian, and in the particular way that it's embodied in Ames? I think that does more honor to the novel at this point. Just my pushback a little bit on your line of questioning.
Could I step in? I think I'm going to come back to this point a little bit later after I go through the other issues that I wanted to bring up, which was, can you guys hear me? I don't have my earphones in. So one of the interesting coincidences, so I'm like Ed, I came into this book because it was recommended for this site, never heard of it before, dug it up, looked up what Gilead means, so something about Hill of Testimony or something. So it obviously relates to the focus of the book. I did see quickly that she's sort of considered to be a kind of standard representative of Christian writing. And so, but that I sort of looked that up before I actually really started getting into the book. And then I was surprised because there's nothing obviously directly Christian about the writing in the book. It just feels, you know, it does go into a little bit of discussion about Christian things, but it's about a preacher. So you would expect that from any writer. It doesn't feel particularly Christian as a book. So I was both surprised and charmed, I guess, to some extent, by the fact that it's very subtle. It's all about subtle feelings about these things, rather than it's not proselytizing in any way. But the odd thing is that I was reading. I just picked up a book I read years and years ago and hadn't read since, Fifth Business by Robertson Davies, which is, I don't know if you've read it, but so Robertson Davies is a Canadian writer. It's about a small town, about a man who comes from a small town in Ontario. But he becomes a teacher, but he becomes interested in saints. And so he does a lot of background research about saints. And he meets, for instance, a Jesuit priest to talk about saints with the priest. And the priest says some things that dovetails kind of with this book. The priest says that he kind of wishes that Christ could come back as an old man, because Christ's message tends to be a very young person's message, and that there's not a lot in Christian teaching directly about how to deal with the vicissitudes of being old, and you know, so this is kind of a, and somehow I get the two books confused as I'm reading this one, and I'm thinking about the other one, because in some ways they echo each other about this. I mean, this is a lot a story about an old man, an older man, and his thinking through things rather than a younger man, right? So so I found that kind of interesting. With regard to Mark, your comments about legitimacy of the writing, I mean, I think anytime you stick pen to paper or fingers to keyboard and you venture into any character who's not yourself, you're making exactly the same kind of error. I mean, you cannot write in a completely legitimate way about a character that's not you. You can, in a sense, only write about yourself. But of course, we write fiction, and so fiction means projecting yourself into some other character and taking the chances that come with it. And to some extent, I'm surprised that we succeed in writing any character in a successful way, because all characters are these projections, and they're subsampled. You get little snippets of this fictional person's life, and then we fill in the gaps to make a full person out of it. So that's, for me, kind of magical that it even works. It seems to me that if you, on a sort of strictly intellectual basis, if you took up snippets from a person's life and put them down on a page, you shouldn't get this organic feeling person out of it, and yet you do. So to me, the magic is there, as opposed to this issue of legitimacy or whatever. I do think there is a question there that's interesting and worth exploring, as you say, Marco, perhaps another time. But
I wouldn't mind going off of what you were talking about, Mark. I apologize for the multiple times I dinged in and dinged out there. I have a good connection, so I don't know what's going on, but hopefully you can hear me again. Before I read this book, I was introduced to her essays. She has at least four collections of essays, which are maybe lectures or perhaps even sermons that she's given herself. And she is highly intellectual, highly thoughtful. And I think I had read two or three of her essays. One's called Humanism, another one was Cosmology. But she does focus on Christian themes. And being not so Christian, I tended to go towards the essays that were less Christian focused and more, I don't know if she identifies herself as a Christian humanist, but she's kind of along those lines of, her thought, as I mentioned, is very thoughtful. And when reading Gilead, as I was going along, I get the sense that a lot of the comments the depth of writing they're obviously her thoughts, and she kind of steps out of character, and it's almost like an inside joke to herself of Well, as a writer, she inserts, he's writing, well, I don't know about you. I'm overusing the word just. And when I use the word old here, I mean it in this sense, but I'm overusing it. And, so it's good for the character, but at the same time, it's, you can read it as this is just her. So I think at the beginning, at least from my perspective, she is writing down her own thoughts. She hasn't maybe quite gotten into the character yet. She's kind of reaching out, sensing that, just as John Ames Elder is kind of sensing where he wants to go to in these letters. And I think Ed said it great, almost poetically, where she's the stream of thought, and then all of a sudden there's kind of this rush of deep contemplation that kind of comes through and sucks you in, just as perhaps if you're writing a letter, you remember this, oh, this instant in the past, and I need to describe it. But she really, just knowing, which I don't know Christianity, I don't know the themes and the topics she writes on, to where I feel like I'm an ignoramus when I'm reading these essays that she's done. But she does come out through the writing. But she does jump into the character very well, to the point where, even though I was kind of searching for, well, maybe this is just a thought she's had and she's placed into an essay and she wanted to place it here or something like that, but she really gets into character and does a superb job of, well, perhaps John Ames can be any man or any person. These thoughts he's having can be, or are, thoughts that an intellectual who's read too many books would have. And so I think she does a great job with that. So I recommend reading the book, and maybe we can have a discussion number two about that, Mark. Sorry, I missed. It was choppy there for about 15, 20 minutes, so I might have missed some of the other questions that were arising beyond that.
Well, I wouldn't mind just jumping back to Mark's point too, about this writing other character, and come back to the Christianity, because I think it's hard to understand the novel without some biblical background. I mean, that there's, she's intentionally playing out themes, like the prodigal son, especially, you know, more than I also feel like, even though I went to Sunday school, I feel like an ignoramus with respect to a lot of this thing too. But now, I just want to say, in defense of the author, of an author, or any author, that a part of the art is the creation of character. It is the creation of the interiority of human beings, and arguably, an author could do that better than a first person could themselves. Like, certainly I can express myself, like there's no not being me, but in the way that I use language, I could be more or less effective at expressing the particularity of being me. And an author, through their power of observation and their practice of observation, I think learns how to express a person better than even the person might be able to express themselves. So I have to assume that, because this feels so, I had in the midst of reading this wondered, this feels like so real. This feels like a real, I was forgetting that it was, and this is the, of course, a successful effect, right, of the writing, but I was forgetting that it was Marilynne Robinson who was creating this preacher. I was really feeling like that it was a real person. And so, of course, now reflecting on that, I see how the you know, that's in a way a fabrication, like you're saying. And Doug is pointing out the fact that, you know, that Marilynne is also an essayist who has particular ideas that she wishes to get across. In fact, she went, I think, 2 decades without writing a novel. She had written a book called Housekeeping that was very well received, and then spent 2 decades writing essays before having the idea for this novel and then coming back to write it. But I think it would be fair to assume that many of the themes and particular ideas that she's been addressing in her essays, this apologetics for a kind of, you know, Christianity and a reinterpretation of Calvin. This is one of her themes. You know, she's arguing against, I think, the idea that that Puritans, Calvinists, Christians in general are anti-body or anti-sex. Or she's trying to, in a way, reinterpret or recast, you know, how Christians are seen. And in a way, you could see this book as a means of really fleshing that out, like in a character, in a life world. And so, you know, I feel like that I'm an outsider to that world, but through the process of reading, and to the extent I can connect that with times I've been in towns like this, or with my wife's family who are Lutherans in Minnesota, a similar kind of world and worldviews, I feel like I can get inside them. And it's through the author, who has this world inside her, but also is an observer and is able to represent and communicate that world to people like, you know, me. So that's I'll say about that.
I'd like to reinforce that, Marco. I felt closer to the story itself because the kid was my age, or about my age, or Mark and my age. But there were a lot of things, and the way, and also the way Ames talked about it, that reminded me a lot of my great grandfather, I spent a lot of time with. So I kind of picked up like phrases, ways of saying things, ways of bringing them across that rang very true to me because I'd heard them before in my life. And I never, maybe I'm weird in that regard, but when I'm reading a book, I never think about who's writing it. If you had asked me in the middle of reading this, you know, my fellow audience said, "What do you read?" I said, "Oh, I'm reading Gilead." And she'd go, "Who wrote it?" I would have gone, "I'd have to look at the cover." And then I go, "Oh, is this Marilyn Robinson or whatever?" And I don't think I would have thought twice about it because I don't care. I don't care if it's a woman. I don't care if it's a man. I don't care what they're writing about. How real, and this is the magic that Jeffrey mentioned, how magical is it? You know, if you're making the magic happen, I don't care. And that was the thing I liked about this is Ames is an exceedingly consistent character. You see him go through this. You kind of move along with him, and he doesn't have that. As Jeffrey pointed out, if you don't quite get it right, they come across artificial or wooden or flat, or we have lots of ways to describe characters that don't work. But he works. You know, he's authentic. You know, Ames is an authentic person. This is a person that's expressing his view on how he see things, and she captured that very well. And I think that's actually, I find that very enviable to be able to pick up. You know, she would have talked to her grandfather, she would have talked to other older men who would have said things that Ames could have said, and she probably did remember and put them down. So, you know, it doesn't have to be, I don't think it has to be, I don't think a lot of writing is a real conscious fact. There's certain things that can be very artistic and aesthetic, and I agree with Mark on that point. You can also take it to an extreme, and it's great if you're suffering from insomnia, because you read a couple of paragraphs and you're gone. But other ones won't let you sleep. You know, this book I never read, but I tried it once before I went to bed. It was the worst thing I ever did. It was the worst night's sleep I had in 2 weeks, because I couldn't stop thinking about what it is that she's bringing up, because she is touching on a lot of things. And again, this is a personal part of that. I grew up in an extremely fundamentalist household. So she's, you know, I went to Sunday school because I had to. And I was always there. And you always had to know what was going on. And my mother did ask me, what did they talk about? And she knew what they had talked about beforehand.
you know, to make sure that I was getting the message that I never got, you know, in the end. But because I don't identify as a Christian, but I have an extremely Christian background and a large Christian involvement. And this book, that's a part that fascinated me as well. I have a very ambivalent relationship to Mr. Calvin. And she made the man almost sympathetic. I actually thought more than once reading this book, I think I have to look at John Calvin again. There are a couple of things I know I'm never going to get past with him. One of them that comes up in the book was predestination. And Ames tactfully avoids getting into it. Because I don't think it's something that fits well and sits well with how he sees the world and understands the Christianity that he lives. It's a sticking point. But he knows it's there. He acknowledges that it's there. He gets into those same kind of discussions with his namesake, who he actually, that I was also very much taken by. I'm reading this, I'm going, how's he going to get out of this? This isn't going to go the way I think it's going. Of course, she was leading me down the garden path. Okay. Also good in her part on how that turned out. But it comes up in a number of places where we always talk about it being Christian, but you wouldn't know that it's Christian if somebody didn't tell you that it was Christian. Because it's simply human. It's humanness in its truest essence. It's what makes us human. That's what makes the difference. And she can address that point. Sometimes it has a very Christian shading to it, and sometimes it has a more secular shading to it in what she's doing as well. It just comes out of life itself. And the doctrinal things, I found that very interesting because they come up a couple of times in the book as well. He always mentions the point and then skirts around it. He never really delves into them because they're things that people have to figure out for themselves. The discussion groups where she comes to the Bible group after, you know, after she tells me, you know, well, you got to marry me kind of thing. She shows up for that session. And the women are really to pounce on her and go, well, this is the way you have to believe. And you go, well, actually, no. His tirade, very many, against the radio preachers who undo, that came up in one of the readings that she did on the tape, that undo 40 years of work. I'm finally getting these people to start actually feeling and thinking about their own faith. And then some jerk comes along and screws it all up because he's got some pat answer that doesn't fit anywhere. You know, I could relate very well to that because that's what my mother had on in the background in our house. That was always playing. So I'm going, well, okay, yeah, that's why I reacted very negatively to that. She actually put that in the sympathetic light because he exhibited that Christian virtue. We call it Christian. I think it's a human virtue of just taking people for what they are, just accepting their humanness, no more, no less. That was one of the, you know, the things that impressed me about that, just to reinforce what you were saying.
Well, just briefly, and then I'll let you guys continue, is that was her intention from what I picked up on reading about her and what she said. Was she wanted to soften the image of John Calvin. And obviously she did so, at least for you, Ed. And in other words, she did have an agenda and she hit those marks, which, you know, credit. So I have no problem with any of that.
I'm thinking, I'm thinking, Mark, that maybe you have, if the writing doesn't gel with one's experience of the world, that's when you start to question the writer's effectiveness to produce these characters, right? So there's nothing that I've seen so far in this book that doesn't ring true along the lines of what Edward's been talking about, to real situations involving these kinds of people in life as I've encountered them. Not that I encounter it very often, but I have on occasion, and it rings true with that. There was another book that I read by a very well-respected writer. It's a book called The Sea by John Banville. It's considered one of the best books around. Anyway, I read it, and I hated it. And the reason is the book describes a person going through a grief experience on the death of their wife, a man going through a grief experience on the death of their wife. And it was so counter to my own experience of grief. It nothing about the experience jived with my own experience of dealing with that kind of situation. And so I found the book almost unsupportable to read this. And I looked up the author, and, you know, he hadn't lost anybody. And so he was projecting his own understanding of the grief process onto the characters. Now, lots of people read that book and they love it. So it works, you know, but for me, it didn't work at all. So it's this question of whether or not the character meets your expectations of what happens in real life. And perhaps you have a different experience with this, Mark. I'm just wondering if maybe your sense of distrust, because I hear a kind of distrust about the character and the way, well, you, I guess you didn't read the book, so.
I just listened to it. Yeah. I just.
Certainly the case.
I just listened to it. But that's sort of my point, is that but this goes to life and goes to Marco's question about reality. We've all been talking, you know, what is reality and what's real and what isn't. And authors, when you read something or you see it in a movie, or it sinks into your consciousness and it influences you. And so in the case of what you're talking about, Jeffrey, where somebody describing a grief experience, but you've got all these people and all these telling you how you're supposed to feel or how you're supposed to think, when as a person, as an individual, for me, one of my big things is that's very personal. And I take that's one of the highest values I have, is thinking independently, figuring things out for yourself. Of course, you have guides and teachers, and Jeffrey, your paper was excellent teaching. And there's all different methods and all different approaches, and that's part of life, and it's very difficult. And it's very human. Cats, dogs, whatever, I don't think they give it a whole lot of thought. But we do. We go backwards and forwards and all over the place. You know, it's damn amazing that we ever get anything done, which speaks to, again, a long time ago, you know, with Katrina, the purpose of religion, its function, is it provides order and comfort to people. But it could, certainly it can be abused. And a lot of people, you know, escape from freedom. Freedom is a terrible thing. A lot of people just, they'd rather have somebody or something that they believe in. Evidence be damned, just, you know, give me some comfort and order to life. And I in the book I just am releasing, I go into all of this, but in a what I think is a realistic way, talking about the divide in the country and the urban versus the rural people and how, oh, it's just, it's turned into something vicious. And I'm looking forward to trying to bridge that divide a little bit. So as a full-blooded atheist, I think I understand, and therefore I have compassion for all these people that have been mocked and in the country. So anyway.
I think there's many interesting ways to go with this. What's coming to mind, something I want to presence in this conversation. You know, we have 35 minutes left, and there's a core to this book, I feel, that has to do with the question of religion and faith and what that means. Because one of the arguments, and it's not even quite an argument, I had the passage open and I lost it while looking for something else, but one of the arguments that, so I may or may not be able to find it right now, but one of the, but that Ames makes is that if you really, and this is how I would phrase it, if you really understood faith, you wouldn't be able to argue for or against it. And what faith ultimately is a mystery. There's a something. it's notoriously difficult to define or talk about. But he tries, I think, to do it in these slant ways. He doesn't want to get into theological debates, and he's tired of them. When they come up, he expresses how tiresome they are to him and how little interest he has in defending his faith and debating it. It's irrelevant, I think, from his point of view. But numerous times in the novel, he will describe a scene, he'll make an observation, he'll paint a picture that I think is, although he doesn't say it explicitly, is his way of conveying the faith experience, what it means to be in a relationship with God. This is probably not even the best one here, but I'd like to just share a passage from the text. This is from page 74 in the first edition, paperback. He writes, "I walked up to the church in the dark, as I said. There was a very bright moon. It's strange how you never quite get used to the world at night. I have seen moonlight strong enough to cast shadows any number of times. And the wind is the same wind, rustling the same leaves, night or day. When I was a young boy, I used to get up before every dawn of the world to fetch water and firewood. It was a very different life then. I remember walking out into the dark and feeling as if the dark were a great cool sea, and the houses and the sheds and the woods were all adrift in it, just about to ease off their moorings. I always felt like an intruder then, and I still do, as if the darkness had a claim on everything, one that I violated just by stepping out the out my door. This morning, the world by moonlight seemed to be an immemorial acquaintance I had always meant to befriend. If there was ever a chance, it has passed. Strange to say, I feel a little that way about myself." He goes on, there's a little bit more to that particular passage, but there, like I said, numerous instances where he's observing something like that, something like a natural scene or his son playing his wife's face. He really has a lot to say about it, a lot to say about the way that her gaze affects him, how it makes him feel exposed. It makes him feel inadequate to some inner knowledge, some kind of wisdom that she seems to have. And I feel that this is where he really is, and the author really is conveying this sense of the mystery that all, you know, what Feuerbach and Karl Barth and the theological, like those are very important, I think, at certain levels. But then there's something beyond that. And this is part of, I think, also what Marilynne Robinson's trying to say about the divine, which Aurobindo was also saying, and I think is a, that there's something so radically beyond our ideas about things. But that radical beyondness shines through in these moments of perception, illumination, even vision. There's a very interesting discussion in this book about vision, the distinction between the kind of vision that his grandfather had, who literally saw, you know, the Lord or other beings and had conversations with them, and was really very driven by these visions, and the kind of visions that John Ames, the narrator, describes, which are much more ordinary. They're not otherworldly. They're not alien. They're the sun and the moon. They're the face of a child. They're the moonlight. They're the, you know, the way that in his role as a minister, that blessing is like, what does that mean to bless another being, to wish something for them? The experience of faith and the experience of that mystery in those moments, I think, is what this novel really is about. So I'd be very curious, you know, to explore that side a bit more, because to me, this is also what is sort of lacking in the modern experience and in the modern world and in our contemporary discourses, that there really isn't a sensitivity to an attunement with that mystery, you know, that sort of beyond our whole human realm of ideas and debates and issues. And I wonder if that's part of what Robinson is really, what her gift really is, or what her art really is offering.
I think what you're describing, Marco, is a sense of awe. That's what I miss in a lot of modern things. That's what I miss even in theologians sometimes. You just read it and you're going, okay, well, that's cold as ice. What does that have to do with anything? One of the books that popped up here in our discussion was it's actually the one on religion and Christianity. Somebody said, well, let's read the Idea of the Holy by Otto Rank. And so I happen to have it on my shelf. I pulled it off and started leafing through it. It's in German. I'm reading it. You know, I'm looking at it in German. And that's all it's about. That's where he starts. He starts with this sense of awe. And he tries to explore the sense of awe. And I know that all of us that are here have felt it. I've heard Mark talk about it, that when he's been out in the woods, and he's been out, just like he goes out into the darkness. He's just going up to the church. But that moment when you realize the moon can cast the shadow, it's one of those moments that it catches you off guard. It captures your attention. It makes you think. And a lot of people forget about it and move on. And a lot of people carry it with them for a long time, because it's not, I'll go back to your fabrication, Mark, it's not real light. It's just reflected light. It's not like the light of the sun that's direct and there and warm or whatever, but it still does something like that. And so it captures you. And this sense of awe, I find terribly missing in modern life. You know, there is a mysterium tremendum, you know, that feeling of where the hell am I and where do I fit into all of this kind of thing? And that's missing too often. And I think that's one of the things I'm going to give Ms. Robinson credit for. She's able to capture in passages like that you just wrote, where we realize that's what's moving and driving John Ames. Oddly enough, in Hebrew, the word for awe, having awe, is also the same word for having fear, to be afraid. So whenever you read it, that's why it's really interesting to like read the Old Testament in Hebrew, because then you realize, well, I can read this and they were afraid. And you can read it and they were in awe. And it's a whole different, all of a sudden, it's a whole different story. So I have these parallel stories that I can read through. And trying to harmonize, where do they agree and where's the dissonance between them is I find a very rewarding exercise. I don't think I'm getting very far with it, but it's something that it's very enjoyable to do, to realize that it's probably not either or, it's probably both. That's part of what I got out of our window reading. It is both, and to be able to experience both at the same time, that fear and awe, that's pretty heavy duty. And she captures that in a lot of those things that are, you know, those passages that you read.
I wonder if part of the divide today is that I don't know that who was talking about it. John was talking about going out in Manhattan and all the people and I don't know that you get that sense of wonder and awe and awesomeness, expansion, when you the sky you see is a little thing and you can't see the stars or you know, the lights. I mean, it's beautiful if you see the city lights, you know, you're up in but when you're down in there in amongst it, it's just, people don't look at each other in the eye. They watch people, but they don't make eye contact. So I think maybe part of that is that difference between the planet Earth as this awesome, you know, third rock from the sun. When I was in high school, Fort Collins, there were zero black people except associated with the college. But I think it was our junior year, all of a sudden this big tall guy came out. He was black from Brooklyn. And he wasn't a novelty to me, being in the Air Force. I, you know, hung out with black people a lot. So he and I, of course, became friends, associates, get high. He could buy liquor, wine. We'd pull up to the drive-in and he's like, you know, 16 or something, and we'd go out and we'd smoke dope and drink wine and beer. And I took him up in the mountains once. And this is a tough guy from, you know, and he was 6'5", 6'6" or something. I took him up in the mountains one night. And he was scared to death of the darkness. Just, he couldn't get out of there fast enough. I mean, he just turned to, you know, the frightened little kid who was, you know, crazy.
The dark's full of awe and fear. That's a perfect example. Exactly what I was talking about, Mike. Because you can see it together. You can take a country bumpkin, so you know, over the hyperbole, and put them in the city, and they'll freeze because there is too much of whatever.
But crocodile Dundee.
I was going to say they made a movie about it the other way around and how he managed to get through, which is all very well and good, and it's a nice story and it's very entertaining. But the reality is that they are very different worlds, but there are commonalities. People react in certain ways. If we understood that, we'd probably all get along a little better with one another. Those kinds of things, you know. So there, you know, there's that general point to be made as well. But I don't know where I was going with that. So,
but while
I derailed my own train of thought again. So go ahead.
But while A Starry Sky will get you to that sense of awe sometimes, when you're in that sense of awe, everything becomes so. You look out the window in an urban environment and it's all precious, it's all important. So it's not just about what you're looking at, it's about what state of mind are you in when you're doing the looking, right? So,
like Allen Ginsberg, the poet Allen Ginsberg, his famous poem Howl is a great example, because it's all, you know, urban, it's all the, you know, wreckage of the modern world. He has visions of you know, machinery, Moloch, you know, coming out of the sky, the grand, you know, the beast of modern civilization. But he's seeing it as holy. He's seeing it as expressions and manifestations of an infinite or divine. And that's part of what's so, you know, radical about his poem. Totally different kind of writing. Kind of even theology and spirituality than this one. And I mean, that again is the difference maybe between that visionary in the sense of seeing literal, you know, visions or things that are not of the material world, and the kind of more everyday or ordinary visions that John Ames has in this book. Because, you know, God, the infinite that can't be limited to a rural environment over and over, you know, and not an urban environment. I mean, if it is truly you know, has the qualities that are ascribed, then none of those should be limitations. Like, and really, it's a matter of grace in the language of Christianity as to perceiving it. It's always there, but you're not always willing to see it. One of the things that was interesting about this, it's so common. Like anybody who lives in a small town or anybody who lives in the Midwest in America it's like so in front of your face that you wouldn't find it remarkable at all. But to me, what was interesting was the role that the preacher plays in the human ecology. Like, each little town like Gilead in America, anyone taking a road trip, you know this. There's a few essential things that a town needs. It needs a shop, it needs a post office, and it needs a church. And so it's not
a bar.
And a bar. Right. Almost forgot. You know, this is something in his family. His father is a preacher, his grandfather was a preacher. But they're woven into the tapestry, into the fabric of these towns. And, you know, part of the reason, you know, part of one of the aspects of this story is the community. We don't talk so much about it, but there's the congregation, there's all the people that he's baptized, that he's buried, all the Sundays he talks about, the sermons that he's done week after week after week. And he's playing a role in this community that has to do with, I think, in the way that he conceives and constructs his own role, but keeping some flame of that awareness of the mystery alive, like helping people get through the issues in their life, the things they've done wrong, the frustrations, all the things that he experiences himself. But in his role, he has to stand outside it and kind of help people through it. And be a model, you know, for them as to really how to contextualize the trials and tribulations of life within this this grander mystery. And what I think is one of the remarkable qualities of Ames as a character is how conscientious he is with respect to that role. And in a way that maybe his grandfather veered in one particular direction, his father in a different one, his brother in another one, he stays faithful to the place of his vision, the place of his connection. He stays faithful to it, and he doesn't get dissuaded by rational argumentation. He's able to engage the theology. He's able to engage Feuerbach, or he mentions Karl Barth as another. He mentions a few books and theologians, the existentialists. I mean, he's read them, but they don't sway the mental argumentation doesn't sway him from the experiential, I think, validation that comes from this being present to what is present to you, and relating to where that ultimately comes from. Existence. He brings up the point of existence, like this. A couple points goes through some philosophical sort of dialogue about it with himself, but he comes back to it again as like that's what it's about. That's why if you equate the divine with existence, then there's no arguing for or against it, because you're presupposing being in the very act. And if you were actually sensitive to that and to the miracle and the mystery of it, then you wouldn't be having this debate. That seems to be what he's saying. And I mean, that turns into a kind of theological argument like that could be expressed in those terms, but isn't most maybe that, but doesn't isn't most captured in those terms. Am I making sense here? I know I had a point, but you did.
I think you got it for me when you said John Ames.
Oh,
yeah. that kind of like brought it together. And he's very focused, and he's looking at it's something out there. Call it a vision, whatever. It's something. It's not here, but he's aimed, and he doesn't lose sight of that in what he's doing. He aims, and you know, it doesn't mean he hits the target, but he aims. He's really into that. I think that really describes him, and that came out of just how you phrased, you know, your sentence. He aims.
Hmm.
And the discussion that's in the clip, actually, that she presents of the cats and baptizing the cats is a perfect example of what you guys are talking about, this sense of the mystery in the heart of the daily, the bric-a-brac of everyday life. I mean, you know, cats is part of modern life, and the idea that you would baptize or ritualize something about that is... I don't know. It seems to me that's in a sense, it's interesting, because when she presents that part of the reading, she laughs at her own joke in a sense, right? When she presents it. So she's, I think this particular incident is central to the book. It's not just thrown in there as an anecdote. It's part of the story.
I found it hard to imagine like a child these days doing something like that. Like just how earnest that these kids were. That's the kind of thing that maybe is also sincerity, you know, the sort of pre-irony. Like we're in an ironic and a post-ironic, I think, world, but
But it's funny.
Cared for the soul of the cat, right?
I'm sure you're right for the modern generation, but my wife, as a young girl, dreamed of becoming a nun, you know, and it was one of her goals in life. Obviously, she didn't become a nun. And in Quebec, it could have been easily arranged, but, you know, it was part of the culture in those days.
My let's see, grandniece, the niece who opened up the shop in Glenwood Springs, she just stay with me. They're all living in my brother's place. He's lived there for forever. He's been married to his wife forever. They're Christians. So my grandniece, she's now 10. She is a chicken whisperer. It's crazy. They lived up in Alaska for a while. They came back here. She had the chickens flown from Alaska to Colorado. I don't know what's going to happen when they start dying, because they don't live, you know. They're all named. That she knows their history. It's so that kind of connection to what I would call weird world, the world of you know, maybe this is your cosmic time, Marco, but it still exists. You know, I think if you look, if people, there's a lot of interesting people and things, and yeah, we need more compassion and understanding.
There's a documentary.
Can I just interject one little thing, since he mentioned chickens? My grandson's best friend, they got a dog. It's a real nice, friendly dog and whatnot. And he was home the day after he first met him. And somebody who was over to visit said, "Oh, would you like to have a dog?" And he said, "No." And they said, "Oh, well, what animal would you like to have?" And he said, "A chicken."
There's a documentary called Chicken People. It's about competitive poultry, people who raise poultry competitively. Some interesting characters there. I think you might relate to your, was it your aunt?
My grandniece.
Yeah.
People ask her when they're chick. A lot of people have chickens in rural places. My hens aren't laying. What should I do? And she tells them how to, you know, get them to start laying again.
Does it work?
I had chickens once. I had chickens once.
Okay. Maybe you ought to have them again.
No, I don't. I don't care for them, because I, you know, killing them and plucking them and eating them and shoveling their shit. No, thank you. Did it. Don't want to do it again.
All right. Let's come back to the text. So we have just a few minutes left, and this book is divided into really just two parts, right? There's the first 215 pages or so, and there's the very last section where we learn about Jack Botten. And since we're at the end, this might be a spoiler, but at this point, not anymore. We learned that, you know, he has a wife and child himself, and he has gotten, not officially or formally married, because of miscegenation laws in St. Louis, in Missouri, where he lives. But he has an African American wife and child, and he's been poor. He's been unable to provide for them. His wife's father is a preacher, and their family has rejected him. And you know, so he's come back to Gilead to see if this is a place where he could bring his family and live with them. He's not sure. It's not as friendly in St. Louis, but maybe this is a place. He ends up leaving again, and re-leaving John Ames of the burden that he had been carrying, this concern that Jack would become a bad influence or would become some kind of usurper kind of imposer, you know, on his family. So, you know, it's there are kind of like these reflections that play back because, you know, it brings back the theme of his grandfather, and it brings back like this the theme of like the value of family to the man for a fulfilled life. This is very important to him that his wife and son are taken care of and that they're protected from harm. And it has been to him a great blessing after decades of being alone when his wife, original wife and child had died to, you know, to have his wife and son come into his life. And so there's something about this too, that I think is, it's poignant and it's relevant to the times. And that's that this, it's going to be hard to say this like without, and I'm already struggling with it, but, like, what is it that makes him a man? I'm going to just speak particularly about in gendered terms, just satisfied, you know, what fulfills their life. And I think that part of the point or argument that Robinson's making, which is exemplified and embodied in this character, is that it's having a family, it's being able to pass something on, it's being able to leave a life behind that continues after you. And the tragedy of Jack Bonn, part of the tragedy of his life is that he's not able to be with his family. He's you know, he's been this kind of deviled, this difficult person. He's caused a lot of trouble. He's caused a lot of harm to others. And he's aware of how damned he is and of almost how incapable he is of changing his own nature. Like that's where that debate question about predestination comes in. He kind of challenges the Reverend with this theological question. But his sadness, his loneliness is that he can't, you know, he can't share a life with his wife and child. And this is something that after a long, you know, a lonely life, John Ames has finally been able to have. And there's something about the way that those two different scenarios kind of juxtapose that I think is, I just think that it's one of the important points of this book. And part of what even people like Jordan Peterson are saying, like, what is it that men need? Why are men so fucked up? You know, why are they, you know, not taking responsibility, not becoming, you know, growing up and, becoming kind of integrated. You know, there's something about that here as well, like that. I don't know. I guess I'm trying to say that I can resonate with that. Like I can, I think that, you know, there are many ways to live. There are many different things that satisfy people, but there's something in this, you know, something that is, that feels aggrieved, that feels under attack in the traditional worldview that has to do with what fatherhood is, what manhood is, like what fulfillment is. And, you know, the ability for this man to carry out his vocation, to play his role, to be useful. That's another theme that comes in, utility. That's in the last lines of the book. You know, he wants his son to be useful, fulfilled by relations like that. That's what it takes. You know, that's part of what it means to have a fulfilled human life for a man anyway. And that is part of what is like under attack and aggrieved in, you know, the contemporary environment. And if for many good reasons too, like not that I'm not saying that there aren't really good reasons for, you know, for women and other people who identify differently to press for their own cases and press for different ways of constructing value and meaning and fulfillment. But certainly that's one of the fault lines in our culture wars. And I think it's part of what she's touching on in the novel as well. Maybe that's too serious a topic, like for the end of the call, but I wanted to at least bring it up because I think it was an important piece. And it's, I think, part of also the story she's really telling by bringing this character, Jack Boughton, his namesake, right, into the narrative, and like disturbing the narrator so much by his presence.
No, that's I think you I don't know if it was triggered by the novel, but I think what you said was, you know, very true of today. And part of the divide is life used to be, the roles were more defined, but people still struggled. There's a universal, it doesn't matter how far back you go, there are universalities to being a man that it's part of our nature, and it's under pressure now. And what was the, when did she write this? What was the publication?
This is like 2006, I think, is when it came out. So that's a whole nother conversation. I realize that. You know, we've touched on it in various contexts. I'm trying to see multiple points of view. You know, I'm trying to make room for...
That's why we love you, Marco.
But, you know, I think that, you know, there's always a, you know, a reaction for, or counter reaction for every, what the hell is it? For every, a reaction for reaction. And, you know, you could see the back and forth of grievance, accusation, revenge, defense, counter revenge. And these play themselves out in terms of how we judge and, you know, evaluate other people's ways of life, like what makes other people happy, what makes other people satisfied, fulfilled. And part of what I think is maybe the way forward, like, is to have a more cosmopolitan, a kind of cosmopolitan and traditionalism or traditional, some way of being pluralistic and at the same time including non-pluralism in your pluralism, if that makes sense.
I have to think on that one.
Well, I mean, this is like in Will, like not just Will, but various other thinkers kind of divide up things very generally into traditional, modern, postmodern worldviews, right? And modern's kind of anti-traditional and postmodern's kind of anti-modern and anti-traditional. But because people really shake out across the spectrum, you know, some, the majority are more going to be traditional. And then you'll have people that are modern, people that are postmodern. But if you want to have a world where they all can coexist, you have to find ways to value what each of their respective psyches value and find a way where they can, you know, coexist. So I think that that's part of what has to happen intellectually, like that we have to kind of get out of the, I mean, and that's why even Christianity is useful, because although in many expressions it could be very judgmental, it also has a lot to say about the limits of judgment. And Ames in this book is, you know, he's struggling with practicing that and how difficult that is to withhold your your condemnation of somebody, no matter what, you know, for who they are, for what they've done. And so there's something almost that we, I think the modern, postmodern, and this might be part of what Katina and Fred were sort of saying, really can learn from and can, you know, bring into their own worldview from the Christian ethos. And I think that has something to do with this way that, you know, at its core, I think the Christian message is radically inclusive. And, you know, the idea that you could be a grievous sinner and still be accepted into the community, you know, still have a way of rehabilitating your soul, like that. Maybe social justice movements can use some of that. You know, maybe they could be more forgiving. Maybe they could be less judgmental, and at the same time, you know, have their cosmopolitan and their pluralistic aspirations and desires. I feel like that there's something that these polarized sides can learn from each other, but we have to do the, like, we have to do the work of coming to terms with the differences, and that's why I feel it's valuable to read a book like this, even though it's so, you know, it's mainstream and it's traditional in a lot of ways, and it espouses good old fashioned values, but like in a time of, you know, relativism and time of disintegration, you know, that could be, it could be very helpful to go to bring in what these values might mean and to reinterpret them in appropriate terms for, you know, for the present moment. Anyway, that's all I think I want to say about this. I found it was a wonderful book. I'm glad that we've had a chance to speak about it. I'd love to hear any last thoughts you all have. And
I have just one, Marco, since you brought it up. I agree with you that we tend to intellectualize these things. I think one of the things that Robinson's pointing towards is it's not an intellectual matter at all. It goes much deeper than that. It's an affective matter. It's how we feel. And I think even a level beyond that in some way, that it is ultimately what we have faith in, which I would just call the spiritual, whatever it is that we have faith in. And if you don't know what you have faith in, then you're probably lost. And you're going to be judgmental and you're going to go at things because you have to know where you are coming from, where you're really coming, not where you think you're coming from, where you're coming from. And they can be radically different. But what and this is the thing that moved me the most about this book, is how human all of the characters were. They're just human. They have the real, they're radically different. You know, John Ames and his namesake couldn't be more different. Botton and Ames have their own contrasts, but they're somehow best buddies all of their lives, you know. There's no reason on God's green earth why Ames should have this young wife and a son that he thinks he has to write a letter to. You know, that's just they're radical contrasts and differences. But what pulls them all together is their humanness. And if we could recognize the humanity in others, like we would like to have it recognized in ourselves, that's beyond just the intellectual. And that's what I think she's pointing at. And that's where Christianity is, as one example of any religious tradition, because if you look at them deep enough, they all start looking the same. They're saying the same kind of thing. And it says, just look at the other. Recognize yourself and the other. You have a lot more in common than you have different. You might think it's different, and you might say, well, I'm special, and I'm my own unique individual. I understand all of that. But in the end, we're not really all that different. We're unique just like everybody else, kind of thing. A little hyperbole. But recognize the humanness of the other. Recognize yourself. You'll find yourself in the other if you look. It'll stare you right back in the face every time. That's all.
Holy shit, Ed.
What?
That's just how I see it.
Preach.
I'm not going to say, can I get a witness? Okay. That's what I heard her telling me anyhow. All right. I'll leave it at that.
All right. Any last words? All right. No. Jeffrey's good. Mark's good.
This was a good cafe.
This was a good one. I really enjoyed this one too. Thanks all. For everybody for
Merry Christmas, well, guys.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
And have a good, as the Germans say, a good slide into the new year. A guten Rutsch. Okay. So, most people don't make it standing up.
All right. We'll see you all.
See you on the other side.
19. Yep.
Okay. Take care, everyone.